Cooking the Books 1, The Spending Review. Governments can't control the way that the capitalist economy works. They can, however, decide how they are going to spend the money that they have or plan to have. This is the annual budget. From time to time in Britain, the government takes a longer view and sets out their spending plans over a period of 3 or 4 years. One such event occurred on the 11th of June when the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, stood up in the House of Commons and delivered a spending review, a comprehensive one, no less, as it was broken down by the government department. For weeks before, the media had been speculating which departments would be favoured and which would suffer cuts. She announced that the total amount to be spent over the next 3 years or so was to be £2.2 trillion, a figure that the Times, on the 12th of June, commented may be so large as to be meaningless. Yes, what is a trillion? A million million? A thousand billion? Anyone know offhand? It's the same every time. The Chancellor's statement is followed by the Shadow Chancellor getting up and accusing the government of double counting or complaining that not enough is being spent on this or too much on that, and asking where's the money coming from? A good question. From time to time, MPs join in, cheering or booing. A spending review, as its name suggests, only covers spending, not where the money to spend is going to come from. Since governments as such don't generate any income or wealth, their income has to come from elsewhere, the two sources being taxation and borrowing. This is where the workings of the capitalist economy come in. Taxes ultimately fall on profits, and profits are what drive the capitalist economy. This places limits on what the government can raise without provoking an economic downturn. Governments borrow from capitalist financial organisations at home and abroad, and are competing with other capitalist states for loans from these speculators. Any hint that the government may be planning to spend money without credible funding from taxation is seen as increasing, however slightly, the risk of the speculators not getting their money back. This leads to an increase in the rate of interest they charge a government for lending it money. This in turn will mean that the government has to allocate more of the money it raises in taxes towards paying the higher interest payments, another restriction on how much a government can spend. Reeves is always tweeting that she is fighting to put more money in the pockets of working people, though not of non-working people. She wants to stop money going into the pocket of many of them. She seems to mean increasing take-home pay. Nothing in her spending review does this. That's because it's not from the government that she expects the money to come, but from employers once the economy is growing. There is an element of truth in this, in that, as Marx pointed out at the end of Wage, Labour and Capital, the rapid growth of capital is the most favourable condition for wage labour, as the employer's increased demand for labour power bids up its price. The trouble for Reeves is that the rapid growth of capital is not something that a government can engineer. It is just something that happens from time to time as capitalism moves through its regular boom-slump cycle. Cooking the Books 2. Did Marx respect the rich? Even Marx respected the rich more than Reeves was the headline of an article by Sunday Telegraph columnist Michael Mosbacher on the 18th of May. He accused Reeves of putting up taxes on the rich because she believes it immoral to be too rich. and quoted Marx as having written in the Communist Manifesto of 1848 that the bourgeoisie, during its rule of scarce 100 years, has created more massive and more colossal productive forces than have all preceding generations together. It is true that Marx did regard capitalism as historically necessary and, for a while, progressive. He respected, if that's the word, the bourgeoisie, not because they were rich. Their opponents, the landed aristocracy, were too, even more so in fact, but for when they had played a revolutionary role. Capitalism has long since fulfilled its role of developing the material basis for a world socialist society. So capitalists are no longer revolutionary or necessary. More generally, in his analysis of capitalism, Marx regarded capitalists as essentially personifications of capital, whose role was to accumulate more and more capital for reinvestment, and for which their life of luxury was a deviation. As he put it in the preface to the first German edition of Das Kapital, "I paint the capitalist and the landlord in no sense couleur de rose, but here individuals are dealt with only insofar as they are the personifications of economic categories, embodiments of particular class relations and class interests." Mosbacher went on to say about Marx, "Marx believed that capitalism's overthrow would come about through its own success. The market, and this is where old Charlie got it spectacularly wrong, would eventually satiate all bourgeois demand. Overproduction and counterintuitively mechanization," he was also quite wrong about this, "would reduce the capitalist profits." Marx's adoption of the labour theory of value, the idea that the worth of any good is determined by the amount of work put into it, meant that the bourgeoisie would only have one option to maintain their riches, and that is scalping a larger share of what the workers' labour has produced. The eventual result of the proletariat's consequent immiseration would be world revolution. Did old Charlie hold that the market would satiate all bourgeois demand? Mosbacher is not expressing himself very clearly here. He probably meant that production would eventually exceed what can be sold under capitalist conditions, whether to workers or capitalists. And so capitalism comes to suffer a permanent crisis of overproduction. Marx never held that capitalism would end up in that situation. He did, however, hold that capitalism would overproduce in relation to market demand from time to time, though not for the reason Mosbacher gave. It was because when the market was expanding, competing capitalists all planned to benefit from it and end up by producing in total more than the market can absorb. But this would not bring capitalism to an impasse, just to a temporary slump in production, which would eventually create the conditions for a recovery. It was cyclical, not terminal. Did Marx say that mechanization would reduce the capitalist profits? Here, Mosbacher seems to be referring to what Marx called the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. This was connected to mechanization insofar as mechanization resulted in proportionately more capital being invested in machinery than employing wage labour. This would tend to reduce the rate of profit, as only the part of the capital invested in wage labour yielded a surplus value, whereas the rate of profit was calculated on total capital. Marx called this a tendency because there were also counter-tendencies which might prove stronger at times, and pointed out that a fall in the rate of profit did not necessarily mean a fall in the amount of profits. It wasn't the iron law that Miles Barker makes it. Capitalism is not going to break down from lack of profits any more than from lack of markets.
You've been listening to World Socialist Radio, produced by the Socialist Party of Great Britain. To find out more and to take out a free trial subscription to the Socialist Standard, visit spgb.net/podcast.